My learned opinion is that although your average toxic Bitcoin maximalist might be able to sniff out this bullshit a mile away, Silicon Valley cannot, because crypto is peak Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley has sadly become peak fiat. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a great piece today. You know, I was thinking that it would be bad to do two Alan Farrington pieces in a row. And then I read the piece and I was like, no, this is what I want to do today. So Alan got this out like on the morning of the second day of the Pacific Bitcoin Conference. Apparently he just blasted this out in a couple of hours in the morning and got this published. I just now finally got to it today. And it's amazing. And it's also just hilarious. You know, the FTX situation, and we'll get into it a little bit in the guy's take. But there's a lot to take away from the FTX and Alameda Research debacle. But it's crazy how prevalent the mentality, the culture, and the practices that have led to this are, and the fact that they are still just kind of across the crypto sphere. And I think a lot of the reaction to it and what Binance is trying to do right now is really an indication of the exact same thing. It is so much to me, like all I see is the fiat culture and the fiat VC financial mental framing being put into crypto and thinking that it's going to play out the same way that it does in fiat finance, which only survives because of a money printer and because of the ability to constantly manipulate interest rates. It's just incompatible with Bitcoin. It's incompatible with the space, with the idea of sound money. And they're going to clash. It's going to blow up in your face if you think you can take those practices and apply them to a fundamentally different foundation. But there's a lot more to it, and particularly in the context of like the VC mentality or the VC culture and Silicon Valley, Farrington brings us another really entertaining and also just packed full of we're not going to take any prisoners sort of obvious truths to me, at least. So we will let him take it away. Really quick, though, I just want to thank our sponsors before we jump into it. I tell you what, there is nothing so comforting as knowing that the services I use are not subject or are not exposed to the insanity that is happening with the crypto space. Swan Bitcoin, for instance, lets me automatically purchase and automatically withdraw my coins. I don't even have any coins on Swan Bitcoin. They automatically send it to me when I purchase it. So even if they are working with a company who's working with a company who's invested in Alameda Research or whatever, and they start having problems, I still have my coins because of how Swan works. And they encourage me. They teach me. They will literally answer my questions and help me out. They have all the resources necessary. You have got to check out Swan if you do not know what it's like to work with a serious, Bitcoin-only, responsible, and competent team. That is at swanbitcoin.com. And then for your fiat life, you're going to want sats back, because fiat is a total pain. And it hurts, and it's terrible to use, but Fold and the Fold debit card will literally pay you sats to use fiat. And with the price down, I have been stacking sats like crazy. And with the Airbnb and the travel expenses and the Ubers, like while I was all at Swan Bitcoin's Pacific Bitcoin Conference, man, I was like 3-4% back on some of those gift cards. It is hard to beat. You've got to check it out. I think I got another like 700,000 sats literally in like the last 6 days. And then lastly, where are you going to keep all that stuff safe? Guys, you know, just everywhere that you buy If you buy Bitcoin, you don't own it until it's on your cold card, until it is behind your keys. If there is ever a time to learn that lesson, it is right now. Please get yourself a hardware wallet. You can get a 5% discount with code BitcoinAudible at CoinKite.com. They literally have numerous hardware devices to secure your Bitcoin. Cold Card is super versatile and really easy to use. BTC Sessions has all the tutorials you will ever need on it. My DMs are open if you ever have any lack of familiarity and you just, you know, want to get over the hump and it's you're trying to hold your keys for the first time, please feel free to DM me. I will help however I can or point you in the right direction. And you can get all those fancy links and the discounts and everything right in the show notes. So with that out of the way, now that you know that you are going to be holding your keys very, very soon, if you are not, we will get into today's amazing read. And it's titled, Crypto is Peak Silicon Valley by Alan Farrington. And Silicon Valley has sadly become peak fiat. Among all the chortling over the demise of FTX, one hilariously timed document stands out. Sequoia Capital's puff piece from a mere 6 weeks ago. Now deleted but archived here for your reading pleasure, Adam Fisher boasted to the world that, in effect, Sam Bankman-Fried is the most brilliant, unorthodox, and ethical entrepreneur alive today, and possibly who has ever lived, and Sequoia is oh so very wise to have backed him. Given we now know that SBF pulled off securities fraud on an unprecedented scale, and may yet find out more, it's only been 3 days, and is not so much an entrepreneur as a brilliant, unorthodox, unethical con artist, one wonders, who could possibly have seen this coming? But then one actually reads the puff piece and thinks to oneself, are you f***ing kidding me? How many red flags do you need before you decide not to destroy billions of dollars of other people's money on the stupidest idea you've ever heard? At a certain point, at a certain fiduciary responsibility, and at a certain ability to see things coming, you have to wonder if maybe this is partly your fault too. I really do encourage the reader to peruse this rather long article for themselves, but to pick out what to me are the two most hilarious examples. First, SBF tells the writer that he, quote, doesn't read books, and that if you wrote a book, you f***ed up, and it should have been a 6-paragraph blog post. Rather than an intelligent response to such an utterance, such as, what a f***ing moron, our intrepid explorer of SBF's mind thinks to himself, quote, wouldn't someone with IQ points to spare realize that dismissing books, all books, as essentially worthless might rile a writer? Was he playing with me? Is this fun? Is this humor? I'm satisfied with my meta-analysis until I realize that one can always increment the level of strategic play in this sort of game. It's like poker. Level 1 is just thinking about how to strengthen your own hand. Level 2 is thinking about what your opponent's hand is. Level 3 is thinking about what your opponent thinks your hand is, and so on. And since SBF is obviously a genius, I should simply assume that compared with me, SBF will always be playing at level N plus 1, which makes my analysis of the intent behind SBF's books are for losers idea spiral into infinity and crash, like a computer program stuck in a loop. End quote. I just want to add from Guy Swan here personally, that was the actual quote. I almost didn't believe it. I thought Alan was being sarcastic. And I looked it up and I read it word for word. That is what it says in the article. Second, Fisher writes that FTX's competitive advantage is, quote, ethical behavior. No, really. No, stop laughing and just read it. I swear I am not making this up. And so we are forced to ask, why would a blue-chip Silicon Valley firm think this person is trustworthy? Why would you boast about this exchange to your LPs rather than never ever mention it again and tell him to keep his goddamn mouth shut when journalists ask him these kinds of questions? What is actually wrong with these people? And why do they have so much capital to deploy? My learned opinion is that although your average toxic Bitcoin maximalist might be able to sniff out this bullshit a mile away, Silicon Valley cannot, because crypto is peak Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley has sadly become peak fiat. It isn't just that they misunderstand the innovation that Bitcoin represents. It is deeper and more cultural than this. They cannot understand Bitcoin because Bitcoin is fundamentally counter to the socioeconomic trends that Silicon Valley has come to embody and to emanate. Trends which are, at root, the inevitable result of the fiat corruption of prices, information, incentives, and everything else in between. Trends that overpower and distract from any real understanding of capital, money, and the principles of economics, and overwhelm you into thinking something as obviously ridiculously dangerous and parasitic as FTX is a good idea. I will highlight three such trends here, but will leave it to the reader's imagination to ponder the likely many, many more threads to be followed. Yield chasing, dematerialization, and monopolization of access. Yield chasing. Silicon Valley's increased perceived economic and social importance does not, as they would have you believe, follow from their brilliance in identifying technological disruption and making the world a better place. It is not a function of the capital they allocate, but rather the capital that is allocated to them. It is a function of the fundamental insolvency of pension funds all over the world, but particularly in the US. Of course, this is very much a fiat problem. Global asset management is 10x the size it would need to be if it were possible for individuals to store their wealth in functioning money. The demand for its service in the first place originates from the desperate and perpetual chase for yield that inflationary money inflicts on those further and further from the fiat spigot. In other words, Bitcoin fixes this. The extent of leverage, unavoidable capital misallocation, and structurally necessary progressive lowering of interest rates that inevitably follows from fiat means that even the funds themselves increasingly need to chase yield. This and this alone explains Silicon Valley as a cultural phenomenon. Far more important, more impactful, and more high-returning investments were made by Silicon Valley in the 70s and 80s, and yet the average person had never heard of this metonym. It is only in the past 30 years, and especially the past 10, that the self-importance and cultural cachet of the cohort has ballooned out of any explicability. Naturally, what has followed is an explosion of profitless, jam-tomorrow so-called tech companies that makes the problem of capital misallocation even worse in some. It is easy to see that crypto is exactly this on steroids. The shift in return requirements inevitably leads to investment theses comprising increasingly low probabilities of increasingly high payoffs, to the point that there aren't even coherent grounds to object to obvious stupidity and fraud, because, hey, it might work. Case in point, for FTX, stupidity and fraud did actually work for quite a long time. Throw in the novel, to Silicon Valley, component of increasingly high exit liquidity, and you check the last fiat box of ultra-high time preference and indifference to real capital formation over long periods of time. Once emblematic of low time preference investing, Silicon Valley has been pwned by fiat to the other extreme, crypto. Dematerialization. Silicon Valley used to make and sell useful stuff. While the following is clearly a crude generalization, it is accurate per the median investment and per the shift in cultural norm. It has gradually transitioned to making and selling software, then to renting access to software, then to renting access to useful stuff. This isn't packaged as dematerialization, but as disruption. Not as dystopian, but as efficient. Of course, the reality is that it is incredibly high time preference. It is a form of leverage, too. Leverage needn't be debt specifically, but can be understood more in the abstract as an induced vulnerability to shocks traded for a magnified gain in their absence. Bitcoin opposes this trend across multiple dimensions. Given it is clearly averse to leverage and goes to great pains to avoid introducing new vectors of attack and hence more vulnerabilities by prioritizing censorship resistance by way of decentralization. But also, an even simpler defense against vulnerability of any kind is reliable savings. The social vision of Bitcoin is to get you off the hamster wheel. In other words, Bitcoin fixes this too. Renting access to stuff you need is fine, so long as your need for it is perfectly predictable, but calling this efficient is an intellectual scam. Once the immature and pseudo-intellectual appeal of disrupting ownership is rightly rejected, one realizes there is nothing more inefficient than not having control over resources you require. Crypto is the idiotic apotheosis of this trend, where they just sell you nothing at all. You give them money and they give you the warm fuzzy feeling of having broken into the old boys club of world-changing technology investors. What you are buying is most charitably described as ephemeral cachet and least charitably described with lots and lots of swear words. Dan Held amusingly captured the pseudo-intellectual appeal of this investment approach in his January 2021 newsletter, writing, quote, ICOs disrupted the VC model. What more meta way to invest than investing in something that is disrupting yourself? Investing in the disruption of investing. Dude. Whoa. You will own nothing and you will be happy. Monopolization of access. The pre-crypto stopping point of the march to own nothing was renting access to useful stuff, or platform marketplaces. As economic phenomena, these represent a kind of Faustian bargain, because while users do undeniably gain transactional efficiency, they do so at the cost of signing over the rights to rent-seek in the long term. A uniform marketplace is great insofar as what has been made uniform is not access, but information. This is kind of like saying, as long as it's predicated on an open source protocol. But crypto has again taken this to the idiotic extremity of not only needing to use their marketplace, but also needing to use their money. This immediately leads us down the well-worn path of the fight for liquidity, the pointlessness of reintroducing barter, the technical necessity of decentralization, the applicability of securities law, and so on and so forth. It is a precise inversion of the legitimate promise offered by Bitcoin. A better money for everything, not a worse money for one thing, which can be easily integrated into open source protocols to better monetize decentralized access to a marketplace that no longer needs to be manifested as a single monopolistic entity. Last but not least, Bitcoin fixes this as well. We are all well versed in these arguments, but I want to focus for a moment longer not on why these arguments are valid, but rather from what intellectual starting point one would be inclined to regard them as invalid, and in particular for reasons of cultural bias rather than intellectual seriousness. The answer is very simply that this model, were it to make any economic or technical sense, is a wet dream to the degenerate Silicon Valley psyche. The idea is, in essence, to extend closed systems of user control to the money required to commercially engage with the system itself. Embrace, extend, and extinguish salability, except via exchanges that they also control. Anybody know a good exchange worth investing in? Once again, should blue-chip Silicon Valley investment firms have known that SBF was a moron and FTX a scam? One needn't even point to the hilariously fiat traits of what was effectively a fractional reserve credit crisis that knocked over the first domino, and from which FTX limped along half alive, not at all solvent, until, finally, being put out of its misery. One can instead realize that the corrupting power of fiat has corrupted Silicon Valley to the extreme. It has warped the incentives of capital allocation so monstrously as to create a bullhorn blasting the cultural noise of high time preference through every price signal and every media channel alike. Bitcoin is the antithesis of Silicon Valley. They don't get it because they constitutionally can't. Once again, how could Sequoia Capital do this? Why would they think it was a good idea? Why would they brag about it in cringeworthy fan fiction? Honestly, why would they not? Follow me on Twitter at AlanF32. You know where you would have read about Celsius, about Luna and Terra USD, about FTX and Alameda Research before any of this blew up? If you've been following the crew over at Swan Bitcoin and reading their blog and their newsletters, getting into their spaces and having conversations with them, this was being blasted out prior to every single one of them imploding. The same reason Corey, their CEO, and the team knew that these things were going to happen is the reason they are Bitcoin only, is the reason they encourage you and teach you to hold your own keys, is the reason they have an automated savings plan and automatic withdrawals, is the reason one of their top focuses is on education and understanding the culture and the ethics of Bitcoin, is to avoid and prevent disasters just like these. They have an extremely long-term perspective, and they are trying to earn lifelong customers. And with Swan Private, they can get you plugged into your IRA, they can help you with your trust, they can help you with holding your own keys, you can have direct access to their team to ask any questions you need, you get access to exclusive events in the space, plus, of course, to their Bitcoin and macro research. And you know what? They won't be investing in any shitcoins. So check them out at swanbitcoin.com/guy. Get your automatic savings account set up. It takes just a minute or two. Check out their app. Start exploring the Bitcoin canon, which is an incredible list of curated content, stuff that I still regularly go to just to refresh or explore some of the ideas. If you haven't been using Swan Bitcoin as a resource, you are really missing out. Again, swanbitcoin.com/guy. So one of the things I wanted to, and this is something I've talked about fairly recently on the show. It was in the capital misallocation piece, and one of the guys' takes after that by Stephen Lubka. And it's about why it is that when the economy becomes fueled by financing, when essentially the fuel for continuation and future investment and direction of the economy is a tool of financing rather than a tool of savings being directed into investments, it changes both the culture and, more specifically, who. The change in the culture is a consequence of who essentially has the reins on the future allocation of capital in the economy. When it is savers, when savers essentially, when you're in an economy that, go back 40 years or 50 years in this country, what you had is the sales from last month's, like take a grocery store, the sales from last month's, the profits from last month's sales to customers is what fuels the purchase. It's the savings necessary and that is used in order to purchase new inventory for the next month. You're ahead of the game. And so if you have a bad month, you can either do financing in order to get across the bad gap, or You specifically change what kind of inventory you purchase in relation to where you lost the profit, because maybe you purchased too many dairy products and there was a shortage in demand for some reason, or there was suddenly a disaster and, you know, there was a recall or, you know, whatever. But you made a bad choice last month, and so your lesser profits are directed to change the inventory that you sell in order to respond to what you now project as a new future that was no longer, that was not at first obvious to you. But the saver is the one who directs it, the one who has already earned the money. The investment has skin in the game, and the investment must be solvent, because debt has a real price. Debt has a huge interest rate, particularly at a time when profits are low, when you have to redirect how you're investing in things and how you're making expenses, because suddenly things are tighter and you can't just take out a loan, a $1 billion loan at 0%, and just allocate enormous amounts of capital and hire thousands of people as if the cost is completely meaningless. And all you need is to actually grow the price of your stock, which is going to be self-fulfilling if you're financing and dumping more money into it, and we're actually doing this through issued money, well, then the nominal value of the stock is just going to go up because you're increasing the nominal amount of money chasing it. But just by its nature, when financing is issued out of thin air, when debt is issued out of thin air, when financing is manipulated to be below the cost of capital, well, insanely below the real cost of capital in the economy, it is no longer the saver. It is no longer sound investment. It is no longer skin in the game decision making. It is no longer the solvent responsible players that decide what the new decisions are in the economy, that direct the investment in a certain, the investment, the success, and thus the culture of the economy in a certain direction. It is the financiers. It is the banks who get the privilege, the political privilege, of printing and issuing new debt into existence. There is a reason Stalin said 90% of communizing a nation is establishing a central bank. Because you make everything about the economy political. Everything becomes a political decision. Favor becomes like investment potential, like whether or not you are investment worthy, your credit worthiness becomes a consequence of politics, because the banks themselves have the issued power and the charters from the political apparatus, and they only want to fund politically friendly banks. It becomes this giant revolving door of corruption and allocating capital with no skin in the game, no solvency, no responsibility, and no actual investment path. It doesn't have to make a return, it has to make a nominal gain, which when you're printing money, everything big and everything the banks decide to invest that financing in is going to have a nominal gain because you're printing money to pay for it. It's just the Cantillon effect. They're just circling it back around into their own accounts. So how did Silicon Valley become this? Well, what market could you possibly think of is more VC directed, is more financed than Silicon Valley? And you know, there's a notion of, actually, let me hit this quote. There's a really great quote on this. Yeah, here it is. So Alan Farrington hits this. He says, "My learned opinion is that although your average toxic Bitcoin maximalist might be able to sniff out this bullshit a mile away, Silicon Valley cannot. Because crypto is peak Silicon Valley, and Silicon Valley has sadly become peak fiat." So, because fiat financing bloats and distorts every market it comes to dominate, it most importantly distorts those markets, the products, or the businesses that have the greatest capacity to grow very quickly in either value or size. And that also includes like assets or commodities, and that's why housing was one of the massive markets for the financing bubble in the early 2000s. And software could not be a more perfect extension of it, is that it gets more and more ephemeral. It gets more and more financing for financing's sake. and what can possibly grow faster with less overhead and less real value and capital formation, all of the problems that come with it, than software. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the faster that they can get users, the faster they can grow and work to actually lock in those users to keep the financing circle going. Which I think is a large part of why we've kind of moved entirely into this kind of like, the internet has moved from this, you own everything that you own your data, you own a movie when you buy it, et cetera, and you have control over it, to this market of pure rent seeking. Of, you know, Alan even brings it up in this piece, the WEF slogan of, you will own nothing and you will be happy. You will rent your entire world from other people who own it. You will borrow it from your masters and they will take it away if you do not behave properly, if you do not share the right opinions. PayPal is going to fine you if you tweet the wrong thing. They are using their privileged access, they're using their monopolized access and their walled garden networks in order to control you. And the fortuitous feedback loop of rent seekers who have replaced all of our open protocols with essentially centralized closed networks that they own, that they surveil, and where they take away your access like bitter, self-righteous parents, and where things have become subscriptions that don't make sense. Some things have been great. In some ways, there's elements to the idea that actually makes sense, specifically things that you don't necessarily need all the time or where you need constant support, but like the idea of literally everything in your life, trying to force this model on things that do not make sense, I think is a consequence of this culture, this desperately trying to own the network. And that this is one of those things that is easy to get financing. It's one of those things that creates bigness for the sake of bigness and to enable the control of communication. And this is why Bitcoin is such an unbelievable threat, because they have been barreling in this direction at an unbelievable pace. And Bitcoin is basically this thorn in their side that suggests that the writing is on the wall of that the future that they want to have is not actually going to be the future unless they grasp as much control as they can, as fast as they can. And I think crypto is a great example of taking that to its extreme. In fact, there's actually a really good, I think that's another one of the quotes that I saved here. Yes, so another quote from Farrington in this article says, "A uniform marketplace is great insofar as what has been made uniform is not access, but information." This is kind of like saying, as long as it's predicated on an open source protocol. But crypto has again taken this to the idiotic extremity of not only needing to use their marketplace, but also needing to use their money. So this is one of those things that's so interesting to think about, because I think it's really profound in trying to wrap your head around what Bitcoin can accomplish. Like, I think the reason Bitcoin is so powerful is because it can finally break what I consider a deeply negative trend of the closed and permissioned marketplaces that have come to dominate the web. The closed, inoperable, incompatible networks that we have essentially recreated over and over. These walled gardens that are powerful and monetizable for the sake, because they are walled gardens, not because they provide a useful service, but because they provide useful connection. In other words, they are the AT&T of the new internet. What they are trying to do is get big as they can, as fast as they can, offer some simple service that's just enough to get users, and then they can trap those users in and they can charge and control access by establishing the network that you cannot exit from. I can only send Cash App payments to Cash App users. I can only send Venmo payments to Venmo users. I can only tweet to Twitter users. I can only message Facebook users. I can only Instagram my butt in a new thong on the beach, which everybody is obviously going to follow me for now, because everybody's like, wait, what is Guy's Instagram account happening right now? On Instagram with other Instagram users. And the model has literally become become dependent on this concept of getting as much financing as possible. And VCs are just throwing financing at everything, trying to chase any sort of gain, which has become completely materially detached from the reality of the economy, from all of the actual resources that they are sucking up and trying to do this. Such a good example is Elon Musk just talking about how Twitter is paying $400 per meal to offer free lunch for people in the building. And if you've ever seen some of those like peak Silicon Valley, like Instagram stories or whatever, where they're like, oh, I got my soy latte from the machine this morning, and then I went and I did a little bit of yoga in the trance room, and then I played a little bit of video games. I got some work done for about 10 minutes. I went for a walk and got a hamburger at an organic soy plant-based hamburger at blah, blah. Like, I mean, just like some of these things, like this is Silicon Valley. It is. They don't even know what to do with the resources. This is why a company like Twitter, you compare Twitter to Telegram. So Telegram has 700 million active users, and they have like, I think it was 179 employees. I mean, that might vary a little bit, but it's very few employees considering. Whereas Twitter has 400 million users, so 300 fewer million users, and 7,500 employees. In a world where capital actually costs, actually has a real cost, that it's actually got a market price that is equal for all participants based on the investment potential and the growth potential, Twitter would already be out of business. That level of waste and uselessness, there is clearly, let's say that for some reason the way Twitter works does need more employees. Max, you could argue it's like 2x or 3x the number of employees. I think that's a stretch. I think that's nonsense. But it doesn't need 42 times the number of employees. Or somewhere between 70 to 80 times the number of employees per number of users. But the two big reasons, at least in my thinking, that these sorts of networks can have this degree of waste and actually sustain themselves is, one, because they're funded by financing, because they are funded by debt, and debt has no market price anymore. It is completely divorced from reality, and it is totally and absolutely a political construct. It is entirely based on political whim what the cost of capital is. And by getting unbelievable amounts of financing, they get to squeeze all of their competitors and any other potential disruptor in the market of any resources that could be allocated to them and growth potential that they have and real products and services that they could provide. They get squeezed out by the perpetual feedback loop of everything that is big is going to get bigger faster than everything else, because it's going to be the first thing that gets the debt and all of the nominal prices are going to go up. And then the other reason is because of the closed networks. It's because they can trap their users in, and they have walls around the compatibility, around the information itself, around access to the other parties in the network, rather than agnostic hosting to the information itself. And this is why I think Bitcoin, this is where Bitcoin I think is truly powerful. And this is where I think it's doing the exact opposite of what Silicon Valley is doing. And in fact, Silicon Valley is basically doubling and tripling down on that, and on that model and that concept, the concept of network ownership. And so much so that this is actually what the quote was getting to, that not only are they going to be forced to use their network, and that it's going to be this closed, everyone needs to join their network, and they're going to own the network, and they're going to create the network for this one very specific utility. But they're also going to do this, and they're going to create a protocol that establishes its own money. So you're going to have to purchase their money and save in their money in order to actually use that individual utility. Crypto is literally moving in the opposite direction of anything sensible, intelligent, or sustainable. It is so unbelievably stupid and wasteful. Not only is the marketplace going to be attached to this thing, but it will require you to buy and use an arbitrary quote-unquote utility token in order to participate. So what you're going to do is you're going to buy App Store coin, and you're going to save some of your money in App Store coin because, well, you might want to use the App Store one day. And if other people come in to use the App Store coin or at the App Store, well, they're also going to be forced to buy the App Store coin. And maybe your App Store coin will 10x in price. So you should speculate on App Store coin because the App Store is going to be really, really popular one day. And that's because everybody's going to want to get all of the stuff off of the App Store, and everybody needs to have App Store coin to do it. So you're going to benefit from being an App Store coin early adopter. Of course, this may just turn out to be a huge excuse to print a ton of App Store coin out of thin air and use it as liquidity to offload from a bunch of VC investors who got a bunch of free financing and purchase the early sales from the token printers, who are then engorging themselves on free money, and nobody else really actually cares about the App Store or App Store coin outside of the fact that they need to fleece enough retail investors to get in and sit on App Store coin and believe in this stupid esoteric future dream of App Store ubiquity. Even though they know nobody's going to use this App Store because there are already massive incumbents that are easier to use, they have vendor lock-in, they've built entire ecosystems around their App Stores, and they don't force anybody to buy some idiotic App Store coin and entice a bunch of speculators who don't actually give a shit about the product. They're just there to make a ton of money off speculating on some token of some barely used, barely alive project, who keeps posting all of these great-looking stats online as if everybody's using the App Store, when the reality is everybody's just waiting for App Store coin to moon. But when it turns out that nobody actually wanted to use the App Store because it's got like 10 times the bootstrapping problem of any other network and no value add and actually requires people to take risk and invest in a single-use money that completely overshadows any benefit that the service or utility was ever going to give them, well, that's when you find out you just paid a whole bunch of money to a bunch of VCs who happily took it and ran while the value of your App Store coin plummets and all of your money vanishes, and now you can't even use it on the App Store because nobody cared. It's not compatible with anything, and the closest to something real that was ever sold on it was a URL to a digital copy of a picture of somebody else's artwork that they swore was unique just to you, and that you have it until the platform server goes offline and your wallet won't even display your $10,000 JPEG anymore. That is peak fiat. And going back to why I think Bitcoin is so powerful is that the ability to remove monetization from the platform is exactly what is needed to get rid of the closed network of the platform itself. This is why, and I know I've talked about this a million times, and I'll preface it again that I could certainly be wrong about, you know, there's been so many attempts at decentralized this and that and trying to remove these social media centers and these centers of control and the network owners that we have in so many of the apps and systems that we use today. But I will tell you that I have never used one with as much promise as this. And that, I think, is an important distinction. There are plenty of brilliant ideas. There are plenty of brilliant, in theory, systems that did not work out in practice. This is the first one that, while I have been using it, I have gotten more and more excited about it. It works in theory. It is a brilliant design. It's utterly simple. It is so simple from its building blocks in how it thinks about replacing the current architecture and essentially enables this because it is able to monetize its infrastructure with Lightning. But what Synonym is doing with slash tags, and what Paolo is investing in from Bitfinex with Hole Punch, with Keet and the Keet chat messenger, and how these things are built on top of HyperCore. It's a lot of pieces, but we've done multiple episodes about it already. It's all I talked about at Pacific Bitcoin. I swear to God, I feel like I will not shut up about it recently, but it's because it keeps working. I've got it open right now, and just hanging out in the Keet and Greet room. It blows my mind that this keeps working. And this genuinely has the capacity to separate the network from the network host. Twitter can be a part of the network and host data, and we can pay for, or they can keep using an advertising model, but the network is not dependent on them. The information is information that I own on my computer. My feed is mine. I don't have to ask them to download my data. I don't have to ask them for my contacts. My contacts are distributed on the protocol itself. And it's so simple. It's just public keys, and it's just figuring out how to establish a peer-to-peer connection in the face of all of the hierarchies and firewalls present on the network, and to be able to pay seeders, to pay hosts, people who are giving out this information. So rather than a client-server relationship, you just have a user-to-user relationship, and one user can offer up data online. They can be a super user and have huge servers like Twitter, like Amazon, or anything like this, and offer it up as a service. Or they can just be another user. But their connection is no different. It's not a unique position on the network. Everyone establishes a connection and has a public key exactly the same as everyone else. You don't have to have a website with a special certificate. Your pub key is your certificate. It is your identity. And it's not on one social media. It's not on one particular website. It's not in a certificate authority. It's just built in from the ground up, and everybody is the same. And most importantly, you don't have to invest in a shitcoin to use it. It uses the fact that we have a decentralized payment network and a decentralized money in order to create a marketplace for the hosting of this data. And it's all data agnostic. You can put the entirety of all of the internet services on top of this, and it would work just as it does on the internet, or at least in theory. Obviously, it hasn't scaled to billions of users and billions of websites and services, but damn it, it works. It works right now, and it has a lot of promise. In fact, there's the very nature of how it works suggests that it might work better the more people get on it, which is what fascinated me so much about Lightning and the trajectory of Lightning, is that I knew there was going to be hiccups with Lightning early on, because during the bootstrapping phase, it has a liquidity problem. It is a liquidity network. They are payment channels to establish access to funds in a payment network, which means the fewer people and the fewer payment channels, the less likely your payment is going to go through, both because you might not have a connection and you might not have liquidity to your destination. But the more and more people get on it, the better it works, the more reliable liquidity is, the more various the number of paths you can take to actually get your payment to go through. And in doing so, Lightning Network scales positively. The more users, the better it is at doing its job. And Holepunch and this peer-to-peer network actually has the exact same situation. The more users are on it and the more users go to access a certain content, the more likely that information is going to be there and be available when other people come into the network to try to grab it. And of course, the more people who actually establish an ID and have a public key on this system and establish, you know, trusted users and friends in this network, the better it is to use as a default mechanism for an RSS feed or to establish connections and encryption, et cetera, et cetera. But that is the opposite philosophy. I use that as an example, not only just because it's something that I'm really excited about right now, but because it doesn't need any of that. It's truly the opposite of crypto. It's actually creating a data protocol for a data problem and using Bitcoin as a decentralized permissionless money to separate the data from the network owners, to destroy the walled gardens, to destroy the permissioned access, and not create a stupid VC-funded utility token that they're going to rug pull people in order to create this stupid, insane economic barrier and reinstitute. Farrington actually says this in this article. I'll actually find the quote because I thought it was really funny. Okay, it was actually right after the last quote I said. So it says, at the end of that one, it says, "But crypto has again taken this to the idiotic extremity of not only needing to use their marketplace, but also needing to use their money. This immediately leads us down the well-worn path of the fight for liquidity, the pointlessness of reintroducing barter, the technical necessity of decentralization, the applicability of securities law, and so on and so forth. This is why I say, and I say this as someone who has tried to use everything. You know, a lot of people say, like, you know, Bitcoin maxis just won't even entertain stuff. I've actually used a bunch of shitcoin platforms for the sake of anything that says they're going to decentralize social media or they're going to decentralize communication and all of these things. I have actually used them just to see. I am a tinkerer at heart, and I really don't care. I really, if somehow some shitcoin actually solves this problem, I am okay with that. I will live in shitcoin land if it actually solves a crucial issue that I think is very important to the future of humanity and the future of the internet. But I have not seen anything that even comes close, to the point that it just exhausts me, the idea of trying to entertain another one of these. And I have always said that they are shooting themselves in the foot to make a token with the system, because it is economic suicide. It is the largest barrier to their use. And again, he says, you know, talking about leading us down the well-worn path of the fight for liquidity, to establish a price, to have a sustainable price, you have to have a liquid market. The whole point of a money is to have the most liquid market for a single intermediary or a single totem in order to weigh and trade all of the other things against. Using a huge number of various monies defeats the very purpose of using money in the first place. And the idea that we're going to have tokens for every single utility that we have takes us right back to a hyper inefficient, vast global digital token barter system, which is just eliminating money altogether. It creates so much friction in economic calculation and the ability to trade. It's astonishing. I mean, so much of the supposed value case of the philosophy or the story of the crypto space is essentially, it seems to me, to be antithetical to the concept of money itself. It's like the very reason money is one of the most valuable good in all society is it's because it is the good that can independently allow us to establish trust and cooperate and engage in economic calculation above and beyond what a barter system is able to do. A barter system is deeply inefficient. It's the same. It's the difference between, you know, Dunbar's number and a society of literally billions of people. The comparison isn't like, they're not close to each other. They're so fundamentally different. They exist in different universes. And it genuinely seems like the argument that I hear for crypto sounds like it's an argument to reintroduce barter for the fun of it. Like, it's just going to be great to have all of these tokens for all of this different crap, and every exchange is going to have its own token that we're going to use the DeFi exchange. We're going to leverage this other token to have governance tokens and blah, blah. And it's all just a flashy sounding excuse, because what everybody's just trying to do is print ungodly amounts of tokens for free and sell it on the promise of a product that doesn't exist or that nobody yet uses. And the argument that this product is going to be a closed system, a system that you have to be inside of to use, and that the value of the money is in, or the value of the token is that you can't get access to the marketplace unless you use the marketplace's single-use money. Man, that's a VC's wet dream. That is a Silicon Valley wet dream. But there is nothing about that that is a customer wet dream. That a customer wants to go through that economic barrier, wants to invest in everything that ever provides them a service, and hold money that fluctuates wildly in illiquid markets, and which is axiomatic, by the way. There's no way to have a market of just thousands of these utility tokens in which they aren't deeply illiquid, because the whole reason the liquidity problem is there is because you have too many freaking tokens, and you have one for every utility or service that you're going to want to use, which means that essentially you're locking everyone into this giant ecosystem in where they must be stock traders. They must be token speculators in order to figure out which service your utility token they're going to hold at any one time, which in my opinion is just absurd. And a bit of this is just kind of a tangent from Farrington's piece, but holy crap, some of the things that were written in that Sequoia Capital piece are quite remarkable. I mean, you heard me. I had to pause and make a comment about it. I did not believe it. I literally thought it was Alan Farrington's sarcasm, that he was just making this pretend person who had to explain it this way because it was so dumb. And then I was like, wait a second, this is quotations. Like, that doesn't... And I was like, all right, let me double check. I was still convinced that it was sarcasm and that he was just using quotations as a form of showing that this is what this person is thinking to themselves, that this is them talking. Nope. I went to the thing and I searched in the archive of this properly deleted from their website article. And there it was, right there, arguing that the reason Sam Bankman-Fried said something ridiculous and stupid was that he was such a genius that there was no way he could understand on what level. Like, it literally an argument that Sam Bankman obviously must have been playing like 6D chess and that he was too stupid. His 3D brain couldn't comprehend it. I literally question the mental stability of someone who could write that. And you know, without getting into another whole rant on a whole nother topic, this feels so much like a culture of people who value status above reality. That the pursuit of truth is not what they are seeking. It is the pursuit of status. And anyone whom they deem has the ultimate status, that they literally hold up as like these demigods, these people above them who are obviously so much better and so much greater that they can't even be comprehended. And I think there is something fundamental in fiat that is tied to the chasing of status. But this is actually a little bit more in line with probably a conversation to have after the part two of the nature of man, or the current state of man, from the Simply Bitcoin series, which I think I'm going to get back into. I think I'm going to do all three of those on the show because they are good. And I was thinking about those yesterday, actually. So anyway, let's go ahead and close this one out. A huge thank you to Alan Farrington, as always. And I finally actually got to meet and hang out with Alan Farrington, which was just an absolute pleasure. He is just a gem. Alan, if you're still listening to this, it was awesome hanging out. It was really great to finally meet you in person. And along with actually everyone, I met so many people at Pacific Bitcoin, and I cannot, there's no way I'm going to be able to list everybody's names, but I just want to say it was really, really awesome to meet so many of you guys. A couple of new Audionauts, actually, that I had not met in person before. So thank you, everybody. I had an absolute wonderful time. And it's also a little good to be back home and, you know, in the saddle and ready to get a ton of recording done for some more Bitcoin Audible straight to your ears. And thank you to Swan Bitcoin, to CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet, and to Fold for putting my Bitcoin life together and being such an epic part of the services and education and security of my Bitcoin ecosystem. Oh, and one last thing to point out, actually, is that Bitcoin Audible is actually number 7 in the Fountain.fm hierarchy for like the number of boosts and listens. But the Linux Unplugged guys are literally like neck and neck. They are like right behind me. And I feel like it would be wrong for, it needs to be a Bitcoin podcast. I want to get Bitcoin Audible to number 1. So if you use Fountain, if you have the Fountain app, go over there and boost it or clip it or something, share it out. Because I think I think a good Bitcoin podcast needs to be number one up there. So jump over there and give me a bump if you use the Fountain app. And of course, everyone subscribe so you don't miss the amazing content on Bitcoin Audible. I'm out of here, guys. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, take it easy, guys.
Humans are shit. This thing is addressing problems that don't exist. It's solutionism at its worst. We are dumbing down machines that are inherently superior.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.